to the family of Jesus in ancient Britain, going to the site of what is today Glastonbury. Glass Apple Island, Avalon. That land in the spring is covered with very shallow water so that the hills are like islands. There are seven hills, seven islands in the spring. And then as the weather changes, that land is very good for growing apples, apple trees. The land was ceded by a king, Arviragus, and each person in that 12-part spirit family got a hide as the land grant. I'm familiar with this because my ancestors, a couple of hundred years ago, received a sheepskin land grant for land in Indian territory called Illinois from Andrew Jackson. My distant ancestor was a ship's surgeon, and the ship was sunk in Charleston Bay. He swam ashore, and when they found out he was a very good surgeon, they pressed him into service. They had no money to pay him, so they gave him a sheepskin land grant. And my family settled just west of the Wabash River and founded West Union, Illinois, when it was still an Indian territory. Each of the 12 persons received a hide, so the 12 hides of Glastonbury are the land grant permanently that this land is theirs. And one of the 12 was Anna, who was the daughter of Joseph of Arimathea and the third oldest sister, Mary, Susanna, the fourth oldest sister. Susanna and Joseph of Arimathea and Anna. And Anna then, when the rest of them had passed away, was the last living relative of Jesus directly in Britain, in that part of the world. And because she had married King Belimoire, the king of Cornwall, but because the family had founded what became later on Glastonbury, what became the Avalon of Arthurian mythology, she was buried a little bit north of Glastonbury at a site where two of the most ancient, powerful ley lines in ancient Britain cross. One of them comes from the tip of England, jutting out into the Atlantic Ocean. It's called St. Michael's Point, Land's End, that area. And it runs in a line all the way across Britain up to Lincolnshire. The other is called the Old Fosse Way, F-O-S-S-E. And it starts at Exeter on the south of England, and where the English Channel is very broad and the Atlantic begins to come into it, and runs north and crosses the St. Michael's line. And at that site is a village now called Nettleton. And it was Nettleton, Wiltshire, and it was excavated as the Shrine of Apollo at Nettleton, 1956-1981, and this is the monograph published in 1982 in England. And they say it's the Shrine of Apollo because By the way, the shrine is very huge now. It has been there for almost 1900 years, and many buildings, and revered since it was founded 1900 years ago. And the inscription here was always translated D-A-P-O-L Decimus, meaning that Deus, Apollo, and then the Decimus. But if you're able to look with accumulated penetration, that is not what it reads. It reads D-A-P-O-L, and the A is because it is a different name. It's not a part of the P-O-L. It's not Apollo at all. The Decimus refers to an interpreter of the Sibylline oracles, which was a formal prophetic group of special people in Rome. And they were the only ones who were empowered to be able to interpret spiritual oracles. And the Latin word for them was the decemvir, that is the vir or the men. Decem is 10 in Latin, the 10 men. So Decimus means this man who put this together was one of the 10 who was capable of interpreting Sibylline oracle level spirituality. And it actually refers not to Apollo, but to Asinius Pollio. The activities of C. Asinius Pollio, 42 to 38 BC, and their connection with the 8th and 4th eclogues of Virgil. Now, the eclogues of Virgil are his first great poetic cycle, and they were to celebrate extremely rare ways of looking at the pastoral qualities of nature so that a spiritual resonance would come out of the naturalness of nature. And the fourth eclogue is always been known as Virgil's messianic eclogue, because the fourth eclogue predicts the coming of Jesus. Here's how some of it reads. Foretold by Sibylline song, the crowning age has arrived. The great cycle of the centuries begins afresh. Justice, the virgin, returns. The happy reign of Saturn is restored, and a new child is being sent down from heaven. With him, the people of the age of iron shall die out, and henceforth all over the world a golden race arise. Chaste goddess of birth, smile on the babe, now your brother Apollo reigns. The eclogues, written by Virgil, who died in 19 BC. He left his Iliad unfinished, he said, because he was a perfectionist, and left orders that it should be burnt. But it was written for no less a person than Augustus Caesar, and he would not permit it to be burnt, and so the Aeneid has survived. And the eclogues of Virgil have not only survived, but the Christian tradition has always been that Virgil's fourth messianic eclogue was a prediction of the birth of Jesus and of the end of a whole cycle, the four ages, the age of gold, the age of silver, the age of brass, the age of iron, and then the cycle begins again with, all of a sudden, at the end of the worst of the iron age comes a new age of gold. So that there is a natural cycle, and you can find this in the great competitor for epic genius in Latin, in Rome, Ovid's Metamorphoses. At the very beginning of it, you read about the four metals of the four ages of the natural cycle. Next year, when we go into the condensation of my education, we use four phases because it is a classic of the ancient wisdom tradition of the cycle. It goes back many thousands of years. But it is paired with an ecology of a matching four phases of the ecology of consciousness, which is new, has never been understood before. That consciousness has an ecology that balances with the cycle of nature. And that when the cycle and the ecology come together, when they are woven together, when they fold together, two thumbs occur that are mobile, and if these four elements in the cycle of nature are considered dimensions, and the four phases in the ecology of consciousness are considered dimensions, and you have eight dimensions together, it releases the mobility of two extra dimensions. One of them will be a process, the process of the complementarity of consciousness in nature, and the tenth will be a dimension which we now call hyperspace. And the key to interstellar travel is to be able to achieve the ability to enter and come out of hyperspace. And that this is something that is only able to come when the sophistication of consciousness matches the completeness of the cycle of nature. At that stage, a species on a planet becomes mature and is able to ply their way on the other interstellar frontier. Asinius Pollio, and one looks at the inscription that's pinged in, if one takes not the photograph of the object, but one takes the sketch of the object, you can see that the figure, in fact, is not masculine, it's feminine. This is Anna. This is the mask of the last living member of the family of Jesus in England. And the healing that takes place there has taken place for 1900 years and is a huge complex today. All of the sites are confirmed because along with the Great Antioch chalice, there were five other objects that were bought at the same time, a part of the same hoard that evidently had been hidden because something threatened the place, the church, the community that had these items in Antioch. Among them are covers of silver covers of books of the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel of John, and one can see in blow-ups that the same kind of column, double column, with the arch, curled arch, and this is the way that an altar of cathedrals is made. And next week we'll talk in presentation three about the baldachin. And the most famous baldachin, of course, is in St. Peter's in Rome. But the original baldachin is in the church that was the Pope's churches before St. Peter's became the Vatican center of Roman Christianity. And the first church in Rome was St. John Lateran. Lateran because the Laterini owned the property. It was confiscated. They were paid. They decided that they would put up a great church, and so St. John Lateran has an altar that only the Pope can officiate at. No other priest can do this. So when the Pope is not there, when he's at St. Peter's or traveling around the world, no one can go to the altar, and the altar, the baldachin over the altar in St. John Lateran is exactly this altar. This is how it looks on one of its sides. This is Anna, who was the niece of Jesus. Her mother was Mary, one of the sisters of Jesus, and her father was Cleophas, whose two brothers, one Barnabas, who was the one who fetched St. Paul, and the other Aristobulus, and we'll talk about his family, because the sons of some of these husbands of Jesus' sisters had children, and they have a lineage. Anna not only had a daughter, Penarden, or sometimes pronounced Penryn, Penarden had a brother, and his name also was Joseph, named for Joseph of Arimathea, but was King Belimoar's son with Anna. And there is a lineage generation by generation from that Joseph down to King Arthur. So that King Arthur was a relative many generations later of Jesus. And that every knight of the Round Table had a lineage that could be traced back, and so the Round Table itself were many generations later of the family of Jesus. So that when it came time for Arthur to be buried, he died in 542 AD, he and his queen Guinevere were buried together at the entrance to a sacred circle at Glastonbury. And that sacred circle was the original placement of the meditation huts of the 12 gathered around a central building where they would have their Sabbath together. And every seventh Sabbath, they would have an all-night vigil that would end by having a sacred choir sing hymns to the Lord together at sunrise. That circle is able to be understood and appreciated today because we have a good idea of what the huts look like. And the reason is that one of those huts still survives. It is actually a little alcove in a house. And this house is on the top of a ridge just outside of Ephesus. It's called Nightingale Hill. And this house in which this alcove, the Greek word for this is a monasterium. This is the origin of the monasteries. And this is the house in which it occurs. And this house of the Nightingales was built for Mary Magdalene by some of the most accomplished carpenters in the world at that time. Two of them were the sons, the brothers of Jesus, the sons of Mary the mother. Because Mary the mother did not, she was old. She was about 63 at a time when people lived to be about 65. So she was put under the care of Mary Magdalene, as was the grandson, John, St. John. And two of the brothers of Jesus, the oldest one was Joseph, named for the father, and the second was Simon. And Joseph and Simon, and two of the apostles, Philip and Nathanael. Nathanael is the one who was married at Cana. If you read the Gospel of John, The first miracle is turning the water into wine. It was at Nathanael's marriage. And the reason why Mary, the mother, was able to ask of Jesus to turn the water into wine is that Nathanael was a relative of hers, was a nephew of hers. And Joseph, the father, died in 34 AD, which is what brought Jesus back from Alexandria, back from the therapeutic community, to officiate at the funeral of his father, Joseph. Joseph and Simon were master carpenters. And we have to understand here that the four brothers of Jesus were all carpenters. The apostle Thomas was a master carpenter, a master builder. They were not only carpenters, they were architects. They were able to build anything. And this house has been refurbished exactly the way that it was built. And it was built about 38 AD originally. Is this being made up of whole cloth? Pope Benedict XVI, when he visited Turkey, made a special trip to Nightingale Hill to this house. And they downplayed it all over the world so that no one would take heed and notice. This is the private monasterium in this house. And this house of the Nightingales is where Mary Magdalene lived, brought up the young Saint John, took care of Mary, the old Mary, the mother. And nearby in Hierapolis is where finally the old Apostle Philip died. He, by the way, he lived into his late 80s, and he was buried standing up. And next to him were buried later on three of his daughters who were psychic geniuses. They were prophetesses, as they would say. They were able to interpret like Sibylline oracle material. If we look at Mary Magdalene, we find that she is an extraordinary figure, that she is more and more important, and that it is the women who carry a very special kind of a lineage in terms of the Jewish heritage. The inheritance is through the women because the mitochondria only occur in women. And it is the mitochondria that allow for the special accumulation of genetic capacity to have transposons make special connections that would not have happened. It's sometimes popularly called a mutation, but it's a mutation that can be inherited so that the entire family of Jesus carried this inheritance. They all had this ability. When we look at the way in which, in our time, we are trying to appreciate and understand why the world is falling apart, and it's not so much that the world is falling apart, but that the time form has fallen apart. Time is the first dimension that binds form. And time has cycles. It not only has natural cycles, but when those natural cycles are over, they are over, and what is passed on is the larger gestalt. For instance, there is in the Gospel according to Matthew, right at the very beginning, you hear an outline of the time forms. The generations of the descent of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. So right away, one goes back, David is 1,000 years before Jesus. Abraham is 2,000 years before Jesus. Later on, after each generation is spelled out, Matthew makes sure to say that if you look at this, the first 1,000 years is 14 generations. But the second 1,000 years is 28 generations divided into two 14s. The exile, the return from the exile, comes right at the middle of it. So from David to the exile is 14 generations. From the return to Jesus is 14 generations. So that you have two different kinds of geometry working in terms of time. You have 14 generation sets, and they are expandable or contractible. And the first 14 generations from Abraham to David, making a millennium, so that one now has a scalar that out of the 2,000 year period, the millennium at the middle of it is a marker. It's a time threshold. It's a time form perimeter. But also within a millennium, there is such a thing as a 500 year cycle. It's called the cycle of the Phoenix. And next week I'll bring in, there are half a dozen classical references to it. Tacitus, Pliny, many classical writers talking about the cycle of the Phoenix. Tacitus specifically, one of the world's greatest, most meticulous historians, says that the Phoenix was sighted in 36 AD in Egypt, because that's where the Phoenix is always sighted. But it does not come from Egypt, it comes from Arabia. It comes from Arabia because it lives out, especially in the desert, and that part of the desert today, it is Yemen. And the Yemeni desert has a particular kind of geography and geology. And it is the only place in the world that grows special little trees, bush trees, the sap of which is frankincense, and the sap of another species of it is myrrh. And across the little straits where the Horn of Africa almost touches that southern Arabia is Ethiopia. And it's in the mountains of Ethiopia that had the earliest, most productive gold mines. So that the three magi that come to the witness the birth of Jesus bringing gold, frankincense, and myrrh are traders. They are not traders from Ethiopia or from the ancient name of that kingdom in southern Arabia was Saba, out of which we get Sabaeans. Saba and Sheba. And the queen of Sheba was the queen of that double kingdom. But that double kingdom was a gateway. It was a trade gateway at the bottom of the Red Sea. And if you went through the Red Sea, where the Horn of Africa comes out, there's a little island there called Socotra. And on the Yemeni coast is Aden, used to be a British Empire port. If one goes along the Arabian coast, one finally comes to where the Persian Gulf comes into it's the Indian Ocean, but we always call it the Arabian Sea. The three magi are from Persia, from ancient Iran. And I'll bring in the material next week to show what their names are, the villages, the little towns where they came from, and that they were doing business not only coming down the Persian Gulf to the Arabian Sea, and then along the coast of Arabia, and then going up the Red Sea, and coming through to the land of Herod, right at the time, near the end of his life, when Jesus was born. The main trade was not along the coast of Arabia, but across the Arabian Sea, across the Indian Ocean, leaving where Saba and Sheba and the Horn of Africa and Arabia come together. In the spring, the monsoon winds carry directly across, and one can sail directly across to India. But the place in India you come to is the far southern coast. It's called the Malabar Coast. That's where St. Thomas went. And he went by that particular range. And that trade route goes from Alexandria down the Nile as far as, the city is named Koptos. It's an ancient Greek name for that city. And at Koptos, one has to go overland by camel caravan or by black mule caravan, as it was in very ancient times, to a port called Myos Hormos. And at Myos Hormos, one can go down the Red Sea, emerge into the Arabian Sea, and in the monsoon season, go to India, where one has now all the spices, pepper, cinnamon, many others. So that this single trade route not only has the spices from India, and the gold from Sheba, the incense from Arabia, but is brought up into the great trading city of Alexandria, and the family that owned that trading route was named Alexander, and they were Jews. Philo of Alexandria is actually Philo Alexander, and it stands for good reason that his middle name was Julius, though it is not recorded. The reason being is that the family got special privileges because they helped Julius Caesar survive the Alexandrian War when he almost was killed. They supplied him with money. They supplied him with help of all kinds. And he rewarded them so that the family was able to carry his name as a middle name. And so almost all of them were named something Julius Alexander. Philo's brother's name was almost exactly what Julius Caesar's name was. His name was Gaius Julius Caesar. And Philo's brother's name was Gaius Julius Alexander. The reason they had the name Alexander is that they were specially into international trading. And when Alexander set up Alexandria, he wanted to have people that had thousands of years of experience with international trading. And so the Alexanders were part of the heritage going back all the way to the time of Sargon of Akkad, about 2350 BC. That's when the first great long-range trading routes in the world were first handled. Sargon's trading routes went all the way from the island of Cyprus to the top of the Indus River in the Hindu Kush, all the way to the top of Iran, all the way down to sites in Ethiopia and Africa. If you look at time forms, Sargon of Akkad comes 350 years before Abraham. Abraham was born in Ur, and it was in Ur that Sargon's daughter, Enu Diwana, was the chief high priestess, the head priestess of Inanna in Ur. And that's where not only was Abraham born there, but his father Terah was the maker of moon god cult images. In Orthodox Judaism, he's called a maker of idols. 350 years before Abraham. So if you go 1,000 years, 1 millennium after Sargon of Akkad, you come to Moses, who lived about 1,000 years later. If you go another 1,000 years later, you come to Alexander the Great. So that Alexander the Great is a millennial time figure vis-a-vis Moses. He's a double millennial or an aeon time figure to Abraham. So that one has these connections and understands why the tremendous wind at their back success. If you go 1,000 years after Alexander the Great, you come to Muhammad. So Muhammad is a millennial figure to Alexander the Great, but he's an aeonic figure to Moses, 2,000 years. So you begin to see that when you understand time forms, you begin to get the thresholds of the new energy that's coming in, and also that the old energy that went into time binding is no longer going to hold. All of this world that was put together in old time forms will never work again. The time binding capacity of that dimension has shifted, has gone to something new. And anyone working with that new time, in that new time form, with the new spaces that are coming out, with the new dimensions that are vibrant now, will have the wind at their backs. We're going to take more next week in a deeper way. What's important is to see that there is a special relationship that Mary Magdalene is able to cross over time form lines. If you put the two cycles together, Sargon to Moses to Alexander the Great to Muhammad, and then 350 years later, you have Abraham and David and Solomon and Jesus, and then the millennium figures at the time of the Crusades. One finds that you have to have some way to weave these two time forms together, because they course together, but they course together like the double helix of the DNA. One of the time forms goes into a differential mode, the other time form goes into an integral mode. The empire building cycle, Sargon, Moses, Alexander the Great, Muhammad, is an integral cycle. The other cycle is a differential conscious ecology, so that one understands Jesus is related to the differential ecology time form of Solomon, of going back to Abraham. And if you go back an aeon from Abraham, you get to 4,000 BC, that's the time of Adam. So you begin to have Adam, Abraham, Jesus, and our time are in the differential conscious ecology of time forms. We cannot count on building empires. That empire was built 350 years ago. It was the empire of the British Empire, the empire of the French Empire, the European empires, the Ottoman Empire, the Russian Empire. We are out of the time form of empires, and it's not a political statement. It's not a sociological statement. It's the way things are. We are fertile in a consciousness new blossoming. We are infertile in making empires. More next week.